Going beyond the headlines to the deeper issues. 96.3 WHUR and HUR Voices, Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Inside Segment, where your questions and comments matter at 202-319-7810. Join the conversation.
Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR 96.3, 96.3 HD2, and Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Bramante Bryant in for Harold Fisher. This is the Insight Segment. Well, hope, that's difficult to measure. But for those who are incarcerated, often that is a precious thing to cling to. Hope for a better future and present. In this edition of Take Back Our Communities, we highlight one organization that is working to give those behind bars an opportunity to restore their faith in the possible while in prison and when returning to their communities. Our guest tonight is Heather Rice Minas. She is president and CEO of Prison Fellowship. Heather, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
So tell us about Prison Fellowship, what it's about, its mission.
Yes, well, we have been around for nearly 50 years, and our mission is to restore those who are impacted by crime and incarceration, both those who live and work in prison, their families, and we've also been a leading advocate for justice reform. And we have a number of programs that help us do that I look forward to jumping in to sharing with your listeners today. But it's truly a joy and a privilege to get to do this work and to come into contact with those, as you said, who are in need of hope.
And the program is primarily, I know it deals with those who come out of prison as well, but you really go into the prisons, right, and deal with prisoners who are there. And in that case, how does a prisoner get involved with your program? Do they sign up? Do you all reach out to them? Do they write letters from the from inside to outside? How does it work?
Yes. So we have nearly 200 sites across the country in prisons where we offer intensive faith-based programming. And we make that available to anyone, whether they're a Christian or have no faith affiliation or a different affiliation. But we really invite people into those programs. Our signature one is called the Academy. And we have about 500 hours of curriculum that participants go through where they're addressing the root causes of why they came there. They're looking at values of good citizenship, things like restoration and community and affirmation. And they're practicing what they're learning together in community with each other and getting coached either by a dedicated staff person who goes into that prison, as well as faithful volunteers who go inside. And so people apply to the program. Usually it lasts about a year. And we've seen just tremendous stories of transformation as people step into a new life and become contributors, whether that's in prison or when they have a chance to go home.
Now, this program is actually faith-based, right? Christian-based. And if so, does a prisoner have to be a believer in that faith, or can they still be involved in the program if they have a different faith of worship?
You know what? When I read the Gospels and I look at how Jesus interacted with people, it was an open invitation to all, whether you were following him in that moment or not. And so that is the posture we take. Our Academy program is open to anyone who is a follower of Jesus or has a different affiliation, religious affiliation, or no affiliation at all. And we're very clear of the Christian worldview that our staff and our volunteers hold, but all are welcome.
Heather, how would you sort of, when we talk about restoration, right, also what aligns with that is prisoner reform.
Yes.
So does Prison Fellowship look at it as reform or restoration, or am I playing semantics? Are those two different things?
Well, I think to get to outcomes of restoration for all involved in crime, because of course crime tears at the fabric of society, but we seek restoration not only for the person harmed, but the person responsible for that and the community at large. And I think today what we see in terms of our sentencing policy, our conditions of confinement, the barriers that we have post-release that prevent people from getting a job, prevent people from getting housing. These are all things that need to have reform so that we can have outcomes of restoration, if you will. And so I'm very proud that Prison Fellowship not only provides programming that brings the hope of the gospel to individuals behind bars, but we also want to live out our gospel values in the public square. And that's why we have an advocacy division that works at the federal level and in several states at Prison Fellowship. And it's why we mobilize Christians in a program we have called Justice Ambassadors to be voices to their lawmakers about why they care about justice reform from a Christian perspective.
You talked about values. I saw as part of Prison Fellowship, you have Prison Fellowship values. I saw integrity, community, restoration, responsibility, productivity, affirmation. All of those apply to prisoners or those who are mentoring the prisoners? Kind of, you know, that's what, 2, 4, 6 that I rattled off there. Where do they work? How do they fall in terms of Prison Fellowship? Does all of that then fall on the prisoner or those who are helping the prisoner?
That's a great question. Those values are actually all of the above, because those are our core values that we teach in the academy, which is our in-prison program. So that's what our curriculum in the academy program is focused around, those core values, practicing those values. But guess what? They are also our core values for our staff. That is what we want to exhibit. That's what we want our volunteers to exhibit. And I'll never forget, I was recently visiting a prison during a listening tour I was doing down in Alabama. And one woman came up to me. She had gone through our academy program. She was on her third time going through, still getting so much out of it, she told me. So she asked me, "Have you been through the academy?" And I said, "Well, you know what? I haven't." She said, "Well, you need to."
How would you do that?
But I just thought, you know, she's so right. We all need lessons on these values. We all need to unpack these things, right? They're common values that we can all benefit from. And I'm also pleased to say that we have a research team who's been building a prison culture assessment. And we've been in partnership with a particular Department of Corrections in North Dakota to build this tool to validate it using surveys from the incarcerated as well as their corrections staff. And you know the values and outcomes that we're measuring against? Those same 6 values. Do you have affirmation in your prison setting? In other words, when a correction officer sees someone who's incarcerated doing something good, do they affirm it, and vice versa?
I was going to ask you. Yeah, I'm so glad you're addressing that, because I was going to ask you what those things look like. So when you say affirmation, you know, how does that manifest? And so I appreciate you giving that example. But say productivity, how do you measure that?
Right. So, you know, I think the highest positive prison cultures reflect that prisoners are being productive, that they're not simply being warehoused. Where we see people being warehoused, that is a sign of a poor prison culture. I'll give you a story as an example. A state that's gone through, quite a few of their wardens have gone through our warden exchange program, learned about these kinds of concepts. We went to go visit one of their prisons, and it's a prison like I've never seen before. It was a women's facility. The women were wearing plain clothes. They had the opportunity to get jobs on the outside and come back in at the end of the day. And I asked some of the ladies, you know, "Have you been incarcerated in any other states?" And some said, "Yes, I have." And I said, "How would you compare your experience here versus some of these other places?" And one woman told me, "Oh, it's much harder and more difficult here." And I was very surprised, because the conditions were so unbelievable compared to what I've seen in some other settings. But then she went on to explain, "Here, the corrections officers, they are on top of me to stay on my plan." I have a reentry plan, you know, and they are committed to seeing it through. And to be honest, that's quite a bit harder than the life I was leading in some of these other prison cultures, where violence was prevalent, where there was no expectation of people stepping in to a better life. And I think, you know, that's really a sign of the problem we have in our expectation of prison today. We don't really expect people to come home from prison better off than they went in. But we do. We have that expectation for any other institution. You go to the hospital, you better come home healthier. You go to school, you better come home smarter. Well, we should be holding our prisons to the same standard. And that's what Prison Fellowship seeks to do, not only with our in-prison program like the Academy, but it's also what we seek to do through our programs with corrections leaders like the Warden Exchange.
And I do want to get into that because that's fascinating. But I also want our listeners to know, you know, when we think about prison and prisoners, I think our default is about males.
Yeah.
But your prison fellowship also deals with women inmates as well.
That's right.
Is that approach different? And if so, how is it different?
Yeah, you know, we offer the Academy for Women, and there are some unique things we do in that context. One component of our curriculum, for example, is called Create New Beginnings. And that curriculum uses restorative art and really unpacks some biblical lessons and concepts in the context of what we think is more gender responsive. So we unpack things that might be, you know, particularly heightened of an issue for women, things like shame and the need for boundaries. And so there are some tweaks to the program in that sense. But we still do offer the same programs to both men and women. But certainly I think we need to take more notice of the growing population of incarcerated women, Black women in particular, one of the fastest growing subgroups, behind bars. And, that's something that I think we really need to address in a variety of ways, including with programming that's responsive, but also with justice reforms as well.
Well, that's such a great point, and I wanted to follow up on that. You were leading me right into, you know, when we're dealing about different cultures, different races, different ethnicities, this prison fellowship, I would think that you have to be sensitive to those different cultural norms when you're working with inmates. And I would also have to think that that has to be difficult. That has to be a tricky road that you have to travel. Am I assuming too much or am I correct there?
You know, I think there are challenges with that because, of course, we see, unfortunately, a real overrepresentation of racial minorities who are incarcerated. And, you know, we can have a difference in terms of the volunteers that are more prevalent who want to go into prison. Coming through prison fellowship. And so we want to be cognizant of the challenges of those differences. But I also want to share that I think there's some beautiful opportunities within that. Because when I go to visit an Academy site, usually when it first starts, prison tends to be on a whole one of the, you know, most segregated places that you'll find. People kind of stick with their groups inside, either by racial lines or other affiliations. And what we force in the Academy is as people come to live in community together, regardless of what their offense background is, regardless of what their race is, regardless of what their religious affiliation is, as they start to process these values together, there is something that happens that's so incredible of the intimacy of community that's formed. It's almost a brotherhood or a sisterhood that I think is rare to find, that level of incredible relationship, transparency between each other that I have seen in our Prison Fellowship Academy. And so I actually think there's some lessons learned in terms of racial reconciliation and community across racial lines from prison for the rest of us.
Before we go to break, Heather, I want folks to at least know about the website. If they want to learn more about Prison Fellowship, how can they find it?
Yes, would love for folks to come to prisonfellowship.org, prisonfellowship.org.
Pretty easy, folks. We're going to take a quick break, but don't forget you can hear every edition of the Daily Drum Insight segment via podcast on whur.com. Or you can download the 96.3 HD2 app on your smartphone and hear the program live in its entirety. This conversation continues online and on SiriusXM channel 141 and 96.3 HD2. The original Quiet Storm with John Mons is next on 96.3 WHUR. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on SiriusXM channel 141, 96.3 HD2. I'm Bramante Bryant in for Harold Fisher. This is our Take Back Our Community Thursday, a special segment that we have every week. And tonight we're talking about Prison Fellowship, a specific organization that is working with those that are incarcerated throughout the United States. Our guest tonight is Ms. Heather Rice Minus. She's the president and CEO of Prison Fellowship. Heather, I wanted to stay with, we were talking about male inmates and we were talking about female inmates, but I also wanted to touch on, you know, one of the things I think that was said through Prison Fellowship is that when an adult goes to prison, or a parent rather, goes to prison, their whole family really goes to prison. Can you expound on that, what that means in terms of Prison Fellowship and what you guys do?
Yes. You know, I want to share about that maybe in the context of story. There's a recent report out that actually shows one in two Americans have or had a family member who's been incarcerated. And it wasn't actually until I was working at Prison Fellowship that my family became part of that stat. Our nephew who stood up in our wedding as a groomsman ended up getting incarcerated. And so my great nephews and nieces, you know, they had their dad behind bars and they actually became beneficiaries of Prison Fellowship's Angel Tree program, which serves over 250,000 children who have an incarcerated mom or dad every year around Christmas time with a gift on behalf of their mom or dad. And so we also host some events. We have a DC area sports camp. We just had our sports camp this May. We invite Angel Tree families out to experience a day of hope of basketball and have some time available for prayer for the parents and guardians who are raising kids, often, you know, without that person who's behind bars, which can be a big struggle. And so I always bring my nieces and nephews to these camps. And the first time I ever brought my niece to the camp, we had a speaker, Brandon, who's actually been a former NBA player, but he's also gone to federal prison as a result of point shaving. And growing up, his mom was in prison. And so he shares his story with these kids. And I could see my little niece looking around as he's sharing his testimony and realizing I'm in an arena full of kids who are actually going through the same thing I'm going through. And so at the end of his talk, she made a beeline to him and she just shared with him, my dad's in prison. And he's only about 8 years old at the time. And he just looked at her and he said, well, how's that make you feel? Well, it makes me feel really sad. And so he just began speaking life into her, told her about how she could change her family tree. Asked her, you know, you get to talk to your dad. She said, yes. She said, you know, he loves you. You know, he thinks about you. You know, he's preparing to come home to you. And so they were able to just pray together. But I think it was a moment for her to realize I'm not alone in this, but also to express her grief because she's doing time with him. And so are the loved ones and the children of those who are behind bars.
You had mentioned earlier, and I think this is important, to talk about the work that you're doing in collaboration with the prisons. Now, we talk about prisoner reform, but there's also the issue, right, of prison reform. And you all have this program where you're empowering, I guess it's called Empowering Great Wardens.
Yeah.
I think I've got that right.
That's right.
And I thought one of the interesting sort of sublines in it was that it's written, wardens and superintendents are the key to prison culture reform. They are the key. So are we hearing then, is the person at the top, if there's going to be some reform in prison, it's the wardens and the superintendents. And if that's the case, how does your organization then work with those superiors to make sure there's the kind of reform that Prison Fellowship wants to see and will help these prisoners?
Yes. So, you know, one thing I hear from those who are working in corrections, working in prison as leaders, is that, you know, they don't get to select how long someone comes to their prison and who comes to their prison. And so I want to first say that we also need to address structural issues of justice that result in disproportional penalties for people who shouldn't be going to prison or are there for a disproportional sentence. So that's one side, and that's where our Justice Ambassador Program, our advocacy program steps in to help. But once people get there, I believe prison wardens, superintendents, those on the front lines of working in prison are the keys to prison reform in the sense of building a really positive, a constructive culture in prison. And there's a lot of changes they can make through, not through legislative policy per se, but just in terms of how the prison is run, the respect that is given between correction staff and the incarcerated population. And so what we've done for over about, I think it's 8 years now, is we established the Warden Exchange Program. And the whole purpose of that is to recognize the role that those leaders play in prison culture change and to give them a forum where they can learn about transformational leadership skills, where they can network with other corrections leaders who are like-minded to share ideas of what they're doing, and so that they get a chance to see that there are prisons who are taking innovative approaches to how they do security, how they relate to the incarcerated population, how they foster productivity and programming, and they can get a taste for what they can do in their prison, that it is possible. And so some of the most, I think, cutting-edge corrections leaders I have seen have gone through this program. And I think we've got to give credit where it's due and encourage more of that among our corrections leaders and really make sure that we're investing in justice reform, but also investing in leaders who can make a difference, who are overseeing the care and protecting the dignity of people in prison.
I'm sure that you have heard, you have seen that there are many out there who say this whole justice prison, prisoner reform thing, hey, listen. If you commit a crime, you do the time, we shouldn't be soft on these folks. We shouldn't be spending money for reform. The point is to put them in. There should be a price to be paid. So I'm going to assume that there are some obstacles that you run up against in terms of prison / prisoner reform. Are there any that are so prominent that come to mind that are consistent is maybe the better word.
In terms of the
of obstacles.
Pushback.
Yes,
absolutely. I think, you know, so much of our culture is fueled by sound bites, especially, you know, during election cycles. And I think, you know, America really loves to hear that when someone does something that harms the community in a really significant way, that we're going to throw the book at them. And we're going to lock them up and throw away the key. And I think what's important to remember is, one, that yes, crime tears at the fabric of society. It needs to be addressed, but it needs to be addressed with a proportional sentence. And if we don't give someone a proportional penalty, we actually undermine the integrity of the justice system itself. And what we also see is that 95% plus people, they're going to go to prison, but they're going to come home. And who do you want to come home? Someone who feels that they got a just sentence or an unjust sentence. Someone who spent time being warehoused and has no new skills, no new frame of mind to come back and do exactly what they did before. Or someone who's had the chance to step into a program, who's been treated with respect and dignity and has really changed their outset and is ready to come back as a contributing member of society. I don't know about you, but I live here in the district and I want the latter.
Well, Heather, you mentioned some of the statistics that 96% at least will come out, but also we know about what 2/3 of those that come out will go back in.
That's right.
Is that correct?
Yes, that's the national average. Yep.
Right. And so then, in knowing that, does that change your, not necessarily change, does that affect your approach in your prison fellowship program, knowing that that statistic is real?
Yeah. You know, I think it only gives us greater prioritization of the work we do. That's a pretty miserable failure rate. And collectively, particularly as a Christian and as a member of the church, I want to see the church lock arms to say, we want to be part of the solution to that. And that has to be a holistic solution. It comes with prison programming. It comes with how we treat people in prison. It comes with justice reform. And it comes with also giving people a second chance post-release, because a lot of people come home and perhaps they had hopes of doing something different upon release, but they find themselves unable to get a job, unable to find housing, and perhaps even the church that says, you know, all things can change, you know, through Christ, everything is possible. Maybe that's the message, but maybe they're really not welcome in the pew, let alone someone's dinner table. And so when that's the stigma and the barriers that you're met with, we do see people return. And so we've got to do better. And Prison Fellowship is, you know, I think a great resource for equipping Christians to be part of the solution, not part of perpetuating the problem.
When you're trying to see what is working with prisoner reform, what is working with prison reform, and you may, you know, I use those two interchangeably. They may be one and the same. They may be, you know, two different things. But when you're trying to measure success,
right,
how do you do that? What is the measuring template for knowing whether or not your programs are working?
Right. So, you know, we do have studies that have measured the recidivism rate, the rate at which people go back to prison of our programs. And we have a very low recidivism rate for the outcomes of our academy, for example. We also have done some social impact studies to show what's the return on investment in social terms and have had really incredible results that way. But actually, it was a former colleague of mine, Jesse Weiss, who was a graduate of the Academy program, who had really pushed forward in his tenure at Prison Fellowship this concept that measuring success shouldn't be about measuring a failure rate, which is what recidivism is. We should hold a higher bar. And so he's the one who really kind of helped construct these ideas around the good citizenship values and building out some instruments that help us measure the level of good citizenship values among our participants. And so I think, you know, the measure of recidivism and some of those negative measures are still important, but we also want to hold a high bar and say, are you flourishing? Are you contributing to your family? Are you contributing to your neighborhood? Are you being productive, right? Are you exhibiting these values? And that's also the bar that we want to hold, is flourishing, not just staying away from negative behaviors.
I can imagine some of our listeners, you know, may be thinking, okay, someone from Prison Fellowship comes into the prison. They minister to the prisoners. They talk with them. They sign them up if the prisoners want to be signed up.
Yeah.
But they may also be thinking, okay, those who come into the prison to do this come in with what in terms of their resume? Who are they? You know, mm-hmm. What is it that they've done? Are they counselors? Have they gone to school? Do they have a master's degree? Are there folks who used to be in the jail, in the prison system, and now have come out and been part of Prison Fellowship and now come in as a mentor instead of a mentee? How mm-hmm. does, what does that look like for those who come into the prison to work with prisoners?
Yes. You know, I'm so grateful for the thousands of volunteers we have across the country. They're incredibly dedicated people, and they've got a variety of backgrounds. You know, we have people who are in retirement and perhaps were successful businessmen or women, leaders in their communities, former pastors and ministers, former counselors or current counselors. But we also just have everyday people, because ultimately what we see the strongest need and desire for from those we visit in prison is a sense of community and a sense of someone who has actually mastered these values of restoration and affirmation and responsibility. And we also look to our volunteers to have a posture of listening, not preaching. So we want people to come in and actually.
That's got to be hard sometimes, though, right?
That is definitely hard. you hit the nail on the head there. But I think that it's really important we realize that when we go into prison, we want to have what we call at Prison Fellowship a understanding of mutual participation in ministry. And so I can guarantee you, when you go into prison, you may think you are going to bring Jesus into prison, and you will get there and you will find he is well established. Mm. I'll give you one example. We took a bus trip out to Coffeewood, which is a prison in Virginia, from the DC area. I brought a busload of people, several of whom had never visited prisons before. One of our visitors asked if, you know, they could bring their Bible in. And I said, sure, you can. And I had a bet on what was going to happen. And sure enough, as we debrief after we leave that prison, we broke bread with the men in the program. We heard about why they're there. We, you know, got to hear about their hopes. he came onto the bus afterwards and told me, you know, the guy I sat down next to, he already had his Bible and he opened it up. It's got notes in the margin. It's got underline. It has highlights. He's making connection between Old and New Testament. And I look at my Bible and it's pretty clean. And before I know it, I'm learning, you know, some theological thoughts from this man who really sees God breathed revelation in what he's reading. And she said, you know, it took coming to prison for me to realize I've been doing this Bible reading thing all wrong. So that's the kind of posture and realization we want our volunteers to have.
Have you found that there's different approaches from different prisons in different states? Do you have to be very nimble when you're going into these prisons in different areas? There's just a different approach, a different culture, a different mindset, a different sense of whether or not you're fully welcome.
That's a great question, because you're onto something. Yes, indeed. We find different levels of reception in different states. So, you know, there are some states where the mentality is, you know, it's more work for us to have volunteer programs come in. It's going to be, you know, greater burden on our staff to have to process these people. And they just perhaps don't see the value of volunteer programs. There are other states. I'll give you, you know, one example of many, but Oklahoma. Prison Fellowship is in almost every correctional facility in Oklahoma. And we have even been asked when they've experienced some issues in a facility, hey, would you start a new academy there? Because we know the impact you're going to make. So we're getting invitations from the Department of Corrections in some states. And they're really partnering with us in this work, supporting it. They see the value of the faith community. They see what we can bring. And they see that the change that it's having on their prison culture. So you really do have kind of a range of those attitudes or mindsets across corrections. And that's where I think, you know, the Warden Exchange has been a really helpful tool for wardens to network with each other and hear from other wardens about the programming and kind of posture that they have and what they're doing in their prison. And it gives people the chance to say, oh, I can do this differently.
What is Second Chance Month?
Second Chance Month is celebrated in April, and Prison Fellowship helped launch this in 2017 to raise awareness about the barriers people face because they have a criminal record. There's about 44,000 legal barriers documented in the United States, most of them relating to occupations, jobs, employment, but also housing, education, and just the general stigma that I mentioned that comes with having a criminal record. And so in 2017, I can remember we wanted to really highlight and celebrate the value and contributions that people of a criminal record, returning citizens, if you will, can make to our communities and to raise awareness about these barriers and how we can help unlock them. And so I can remember at that time, the marketing team at Prison Fellowship saying, well, can we just do that? Can we claim a month? And we said, well, let's give it a shot. And sure enough, we've had presidents, you know, across administrations to proclaim April Second Chance Month every year. We've had over 25 governors, the DC mayor, proclaim April a Second Chance Month. We've done a lot of events and social media campaigns in April every year. And one of the things I'm most excited about is we've started asking churches and giving them some tools to celebrate a Second Chance Sunday sometime during April. So my pastor, National Community Church here in the district, has done this a couple times, preaches a message of redemption, a message of second chances, why we as Christians should be a people of a second chance, if you will, and talks to our church about how we can get involved in being part of the solution for returning citizens and coming alongside families, including through the Angel Tree program, who are impacted by incarceration.
Now, we've talked a lot about, you know, what Prison Fellowship does inside the prisons, you know, going into the prisons.
Right.
But, you know, I just heard you making reference to, you know, what churches can do.
Right.
So let's talk a little bit about, you know, when prisoners come out, what that looks like, what that kind of restoration, what that support looks like in terms of your organization to help those who are out, because often you hear those who've been in jail, they come out and they say at some point, they're like, you know, it sounds crazy, but I'm ready to go back in because that's what I know. And it's too hard out here.
Right.
Because it's a different kind of, you know, existence.
Right.
And so how do you combat that? How do you help those who might be struggling once they come out into, quote unquote, the real world?
Right. You know, I've heard some of my colleagues who have spent time in prison call coming home the second prison. Because it is as if, you know, you've been told your debt's paid, but you realize, oh no, I am still very much limited in terms of my liberty, my ability to live out a second chance. And so what Prison Fellowship does is, even though our specialty is really programming inside prison, helping people prepare, change their mindset, build community that's going to give them the tools needed for going home or living out a second chance, even inside prison for those who will be there for a long time. What we do is we partner with organizations who specialize in reentry and in reintegration. So there's some amazing organizations doing work across the country to this end. We make referrals to our participants. And then I've also been grateful to see more and more companies stepping up and seeing the value of hiring people with a criminal record, which can help fill some of the workforce needs that we have. And there's also some studies showing how people with a criminal background are more loyal employees. They're hardworking employees. And so in the past few years, there's actually been a Second Chance Business Coalition that you can Google. Really exciting to see some really big names coming to the table, partners like Walmart and others who have said, you know, we are going to commit to hiring people with a criminal background. And we see that we believe in second chances and that when we live it out, our businesses, our communities actually benefit.
You know, some of the statistics regarding the female prison population, those women who are in prison, some of them really are stunning. And some that are shared by Prison Fellowship, 86% of female prisoners say at some point in their life they've suffered through some type of sexual violence. 77% say they've suffered from violence from their partner. And so I would think then sort of working with those who've suffered in that manner has to be a challenge when we're talking about restoration and affirming and restoring some kind of some hope for the future. Can you talk a little bit about that challenge and the work that has to be done in terms of female prisoners who've been victims of what I just mentioned?
Right, which is really so many, the vast majority of those who are there. And so while someone may have come to prison for causing harm, we have to recognize that there was probably a lot of harm to that person before they got there that went unaddressed, right? And so that's why in prison programs that are trauma-informed, that seek to really allow people to reflect back on what is it that brought me here. What hurts went unaddressed so much so that I went on to hurt others are really important. And so that's the work that we do through the academy. That's the work that our volunteers do as they minister to people inside. And, you know, I think it's really important to help stop that cycle.
Heather, does the privatization of prisons have any effects on prison reform?
You know, that becomes a pretty hot topic. And what we have seen in our history of working in both public and private facilities is that there are public and private facilities who are cutting edge and doing really incredible things and treating people with dignity. And there are public and private facilities that are doing a really poor job. And you're hearing some really terrible scandals of abuse and corruption. And so I don't think that privatization is the only perverse incentive in the justice system. I think there's some perverse incentives for state and federal facilities as well that contribute to those things. But what I will say I find sometimes concerning about private prisons is if a contract has been made that requires a certain bed space quota. Okay. That's where I think, you know, we've really made some perverse incentives in privatization, is where we have certain requirements of how many people need to be incarcerated in that particular facility that the state or feds are on the hook for. And I think that needs to be addressed, but I don't think there is a per se always a problem of privatization. I think we have reforms needed at the private level as well as the public level.
And what kind of responses have you all received from the community about the work that you're doing in and outside the prisons?
Well, you know, our largest program in terms of scope is Prison Fellowship Angel Tree. Mm-hmm. And
that is, that's the largest.
That's the largest. Wow. Because we're reaching 250,000 children. They all belong to a family who's got a parent guardian who's raising these kids with a loved one who's incarcerated. So, you know, over 100,000 incarcerated moms or dads are benefiting from that program. The kids on the outside are, as well as, you know, the parent or other guardian on the outside. And so the feedback we hear from them is, usually a lot of just thankfulness for the community stepping up to deliver a gift on that incarcerated mom or dad's behalf. And that's really, you know, for your listeners, I would say the easiest on-ramp to getting involved with Prison Fellowship is Prison Fellowship Angel Tree, having your church sign up. You'll be assigned kids who are local, live in your local area. And you'll get the chance to either host a party to deliver their gifts or deliver them directly to their homes. And we hear such amazing feedback from them as, you know, just I think oftentimes maybe not feeling seen. And this is an opportunity to really let people know we see you and we want to come alongside you. But my prayer is that if your listeners choose to step forward or are already part of the Angel Tree program, I really would commend folks to think of it not as a ministry of giving a present or a Christmas service project, but it's a ministry of presence. It is an opportunity to open the door and come alongside a family year round. And I will say from personal experience, I've been my church's Angel Tree coordinator for several years. One of the first families I ever delivered to, who lives, you know, about 5 minutes down the road from me, has become dear friends. And in fact, the oldest daughter has been my daughter's babysitter. so, you know, that's hard to come by. It's a blessing I can't promise to your listeners. what an opportunity to be in community and to have, again, that concept of mutual participation. Here we've come, you know, to hopefully be a blessing for a family who doesn't have their dad with them at this time. But here they've been a blessing back in return. And that's what I love to see in terms of community responses, is that concept of mutual participation.
Well, I can imagine that when you're dealing with families and you're dealing with a parent or parents who are incarcerated, just to have that sort of reconnection. And I'm sure many of those who are incarcerated, and you've heard these stories, the biggest pull and tug and regret that they have is that they cannot be there for their children. And so right. That Angel Tree program, I'm sure, helps to fill, at least in a small way, that void. Heather Rice Minas, President and CEO of Prison Fellowship, thank you so much for being with us. Thank you for what you're doing. And we're so glad that we were able to highlight you on our Take Back Our Community Thursday. So thank you for sharing all of the information and all of your knowledge. And again, where can folks go, Heather, if they want to learn more about the organization?
That's right. They can come to prisonfellowship.org. And just want to say thank you for the privilege of joining the show and for the work you do in highlighting so many amazing community examples of how folks can get engaged. We're privileged at Prison Fellowship to count ourselves among them.
Thank you so much. We appreciate having you with us. That's the Daily Drum for this Thursday, June 6th. I'm Bramante Bryant, in for Harold Fisher. Have a great night.